from their 2009 album, Manifesto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, April the 3rd. And, well, we will be doing some talking, some more talking with each other today on Free Your Mind Friday. But first, let's see if we have our connection with Keith Cook. Are you there? No, he's not there. Keith Cook is the brother of prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he is among a group of people demonstrating right now at the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. They're looking into the severely deteriorated health of Mumia Abu-Jamal, trying to safeguard his health and demand accountability by the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections for his deteriorated condition. This past Monday, Mumia was found passed out from diabetic shock and almost in a comatose state. It has since been determined that he had been diabetic for quite some time during incarceration, but was neither diagnosed nor treated for the disease. And in recent months, Mumia's health has deteriorated significantly, leading his family and supporters to contend that it is a deliberate attempt by the state to hasten his death through medical negligence. When I talked with him, we were hoping that he could be with us. He's on site. It is a very tense time, and they are getting no information, really, about Mumia's health. Keith Cook, his brother, and his wife as well, were able to visit with Mumia separately, but only for 30 minutes each, and they found him in a condition that was, they said, quite disturbing. This began a campaign of people making calls to the Department of Corrections and to other authorities to alert them that they knew that Mumia's health had been severely compromised, and, of course, with no information. It first came to light when two people visited or attempted to visit Mumia, as they normally would do, and it was then that they found out that he had been taken to an intensive care unit nearby. So if we don't hook up with Keith today, he's going to try to get through to us, so it is possible that things are such that he is not able to connect with us where he is now. Let's try one more time. Is he there? Okay, he's not there. So we will hopefully connect with him throughout the program. But in the meantime, we continue our discussion on 888-874-4888. We've been talking to each other, making up for lost time on Free Your Mind Friday. It is Friday. We've had Free Your Mind Tuesday and Free Your Mind Wednesday. And it is all about reconnecting and catching up. And it's a delight to be once again within contact with each other. So I'm so pleased about that. 888-874-4888. I'm going to ask that we, you know, just try to be a little bit more concise. You will have, of course, enough room to make your point, but just be a little bit more compact if you can. It's an exercise in trying to get to the point as quickly as you can, but we will be patient because part of what this is, and let me just give you a little tip here, what we are also doing is learning how to convey our thoughts. Since we are going to be engaging, hopefully, in these kind of verbal battles and jousts with people of different opinions, we have to learn the fine art of communicating what it is we are thinking, what we believe, and how do we engage with people with whom we may possibly have disagreements, political disagreements. This is one of the things that the other sides have done very well. In fact, the right wing, as they're called, regularly coaches their folks on how to proselytize. These are the points that we are going to adhere to on this subject. Learn them well, and wherever you go, you know, these are the points to touch on. So they are ready for an argument. They're ready for a debate. We have to do that kind of work because more than likely, in your normal daily travails, you will come across people with whom you'll have a conversation. And it is a good thing to train yourself to be able to communicate your point, your main points about a subject, and to, you know, be concise. It's just a skill. And the more we do that, the better we get at it. And we are able to engage people and talk with them at a particular level where we are understood and we get our points across to them. And hopefully it would add to the conversation. All right? So it's all part of learning how to talk with each other. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say today. Many, many subjects out there, many issues, of course, in the news. But, of course, this is Free Your Mind, and it's fluid. It's not, we have no rules here as to what you're supposed to talk about, except that we hope that whatever you're talking about adds some kind of dimension to a particular subject, and maybe what you have to say has nothing to do with the news currently in play. All right, 888-874-4888 is the number to call, and let's get started. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
This is Joel from New York.
Thank you. Raul?
Joel from New York.
Oh, Joel, sorry. All right, thank you.
I'm very sorry to hear this about Mumia. I hadn't heard of this anywhere. It's pretty distressing news. I hope things work out.
Yes, we're hoping that during the course of the program, we'll continue trying to reach him. And once we do, we'll bring him through. But this is his brother, and he's a pivotal part of what's happening today, facing down with the Department of Corrections of Pennsylvania, hoping to get some answers today. But what have you to say today, Joel?
Well, you know, it's another week and another war. And I remember some time ago I had spoken on your program about the aborted Syrian war in 2013, and then the starting of the bombing in Syria a year later, and we were both nonplussed, pardon me, as to the lack of response on the part of those who should be appalled by what happened. And in some ways, we're seeing it again. And, you know, in this case, you've got another war in which the United States is supporting a government that was actually opposing a government, an exiled government that supported it in its war against jihadist extremism. So it seems to me that attempting any kind of rational analysis of the situation in Yemen and its strategic ramifications really is pointless, trying to make sense of it all. And what the United States has done is create a kind of another burning hell in a region where it's wars of aggression against Iraq and its repeated violent interventions is really beyond any sensible comprehension. And what I mean by that is that Washington supported Islamic extremists in Libya. Now it's trying to combat those same extremists. It fights with al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria and against al-Qaeda and ISIS in Iraq. It backs and participated in Ethiopia's aggressive war to destroy Somalia's first stable government in a generation, and now it spent years fighting the extremists who arose in the vacuum while putting the leader it originally ousted back in power. Washington, it seems to me that Washington's aggressive, repressive military security apparatus has grown to such gargantuan proportions for the ostensible reason of fighting Islamic extremism, while Washington is the strongest ally and the chief weapon supplier of the chief source of Islamic extremism in the world today, Saudi Arabia. And it belatedly backed the overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt and now supports the restoration of the Mubarak regime under another military dictator. It sanctions and condemns as a war criminal the leader of Sudan, and now who is now fighting alongside the war criminal leader of Sudan and Yemen. So I think the one certain thing that can be said about this bizarre goulash of iron and blood is that it doesn't make any rational sense, at least not in the terms that are usually used to discuss policy goals and foreign relations and national interest, and nor does it make sense in the terms used by the policymakers themselves for their aims, which they always talk about: fighting terrorism, national security, advancing democracy, establishing peace, stability, blah, blah, blah. Look at the situation in the region before the war on terror, and look at it today. Libya, Syria, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, torn by war and chaos, extremist militias controlling cities and whole regions, the armed forces of many nations on the attack, millions of people displaced, atrocities on every side. The present horror far surpasses the worst-case scenarios of those warned of the wide-ranging consequences sure to come from the invasion of Iraq. So there's no rational way to reconcile the stated goals with the policy outcomes of the war on terror, or whatever else wants to call this incessantly ever-expanding military campaign of the United States and its extremist and repressive allies. The war on terror began as a monstrous hybrid of imperialist adventurism, a blood money boondoggle, maybe even psychosexual power trips for these stunted and bloated second raters, you know, who hold sway in our corrupt system. It has become the system. It not only, its only real purpose is to perpetuate itself in any way it can. It is now the organizing principle of the American state and its relation to other countries. And seen in this light, Eutrice, not the light of reason or coherence or consistency, but seen through the shooting flames of a drone-bombed house, American policy makes perfect sense.
I have to ask you, when, in your view, did U.S. foreign policy make sense?
That's a head-scratcher. That's really a head-scratcher. I would have to say, and I don't want to be facetious on this, but, you know, American policy in my lifetime took a new turn when I was just an infant, just a young kid, at the end of the Second World War. And when Truman went before the Congress to ask for military aid for Greece and Turkey, which really started the worldwide dream of hegemony and world dominion, he just lied through his teeth and said that Greece was a democracy, when in fact it was a monarchist, democracy-hating, fascist-sympathizing, at least the Greek forces that Truman was supporting. So he lied through his teeth then, and the contradictions and the hypocrisies began even then. So I don't think it ever has made sense. When Perry went into Japan in 1854, he didn't go there because he wanted to expose the rest of the world to the beauties of Kyoto. You know, and when Hay announced the open door in 1900 in China, it was all about money and power and wealth and hegemony. So I don't think American policy has ever made sense. Just ask the people of Central America.
The follow-up question to that is, in what ways does the United States foreign policy philosophy or objective differ from that of the other so-called world powers, Russia and China and others? I mean, we see that insanity is democratic insanity. All of these countries and continents and nations essentially are engaging in anti-human behavior, and behavior that does not promote world peace. It does not promote people being able to prosper and go about their lives. They all seem to have this kind of attitude that there is, you know, there's a divine right here almost to just dominate and control the whole world. That is at the core of, it seems to me, that's what they share, this view that they are all powerful and are destined to be, and therefore the ends justify the means.
Well, I think that's probably more true of the European nations than of China and Russia. I mean, I don't have any great love for, and I've said this on your program before, for Russia under Putin. But he's still an elected guy. I think the difference is, if you look at the way, for instance, the Chinese have viewed the Africans, there is really no equivalent in China to the International Monetary Fund. And let's be clear about what the International Monetary Fund is. The International Monetary Fund fronts as a financial organization, but it is really doing the political work of the Department of the Treasury and of the United States. And its aim is to impoverish nations, put them into so much debt that they spend the rest of their time paying the principal and the interest of the debt and throwing the rest of the country into austerity. That's not what the Chinese do in Africa. The Chinese really make traditional loans. And Chinese want to increase their economic influence in other countries, but I don't think they're anywhere near as exploitative as the Americans. But then again, when you look at the French in Mali, what was that all about? Right? Or the French in Libya, or the Italians in Libya, or the French and the British in Syria and Iraq. What is that all about, if not being junior partners in a worldwide attempt that has been going on since 1945 for dominion? I mean, the difference between the Americans and previous empires in the past is that we don't want political dominion. We want to own the world. I think it's as simple as that. And we do it by dominating markets and by plundering resources. And we demand that the Europeans follow us as junior partners in this process. And the fact that the Russians and the Chinese aren't doing that is not good. That's not allowed. And that's the reason for the confrontation right now. But my point that I was trying to make, and then I'd like to get off, my point that I was trying to make through all of this is that American policy is not rational. And when we use terms like rationality and irrationality, we're really talking about emotional characteristics. And we know that policy is not made, you know, mechanically. It's made by individuals. So I'm afraid to say that if policy, if U.S. policy is not rational, what does that say about the policymakers?
I've contended for a long time that if one takes a look at Congress, there's a lot of work there for the psychiatric community to do.
Oh God! Tell me about it. And you know, we're sort of laughing at this, but there is a war that is looming in East Central Europe and in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And given what the Congress has said, given the neoconservative and liberal interventionist influence on Obama, we have every reason to be worried. Every reason to be worried.
Thanks, Joe. You did a splendid job.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for your call today. 888-874-4888. You're on the air. This is Lead Stories.
Well, greetings to you, Utrecht. How are you today?
Fine, thank you, Sarah. How are you?
I am doing as well as can be expected over here, Utrecht. And also, let me pass on my greetings also to the PRN listening audience. And I do hope that they are able to enjoy this weekend and do something that's more relaxing with the rest of their family members, especially those of you who celebrate these holidays and get all caught up. Well, I'm not going to touch on that subject. That's for some other time. But, yes, ma'am. But, Utrecht, you know, this situation with Mumia and, I call him a political prisoner because he is held behind enemy lines like the rest of us. And it is really troubling for me, and perhaps you might be able to reach out to Pam Africa.
I did reach out. The thing is that they're very, very occupied right now. This is number one priority. As I said, you know, we have to we understand that this is a super emergency, so I was happy that he could even commit to saying, well, we'll try and do it, but, of course, today they are literally
they're doing a rally.
They're doing a rally, and they're trying to get some answers, so I understand that.
Yeah, I quite understand that, and it's very troubling to me coming from my hometown, and perhaps the other sister, I haven't heard her from, been calling for a while, the sister, the retired social worker that calls in from Philadelphia. I hope that she's on the line today and she can give us an update, because you know, this kind of reminds me because one of the Move Nine brother, he passed in prison under mysterious circumstances a couple of months ago. Now they're trying to work on Mumia, and last year they were working on Brother Jamil Alameen, a.k.a. H-Rap Brown. So it seems that they are trying to get rid of these political prisoners who they see here as the younger generations are coming up, and they're starting to revive this history, and they're starting to read the narrative and not the propaganda narrative put out about these people being terrorists and un-American and all the usual nonsense that they like to put out about these figures. So they're seeing that they are standing as symbols of motivation for these next generation coming up, and they're trying to get them out of play as quick as possible. So we need, we need to do something for Brother Mumia, because you know his daughter passed a few months back, and I know this has got to be very hard on his wife and his other children who are out here. So we're going to send up meditation to the ancestors and hope that they're going to provide protection around him and get the brother the treatment that he needs. But what I'm going to quickly touch on, you, Treece, to free off a bit more of my mind on the situation that I spoke to you with the last time with this Oklahoma situation. And I had a chance to hear the state senator, Anastasia Pittman, who was one of the people who orchestrated this Mutt and Jeff show that they put on.
And before you do that, tell us you mean by the Oklahoma situation. Could you tell us, give us a little context here so we can follow your argument?
Yes, ma'am. What I'm seeing by the Oklahoma situation is the SAE chapter, the Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter, the Oklahoma University, where these young men pledges, or I guess they were active members of this chapter, they were on this bus and they were letting it loose with how they're not going to let another nigger in their chapter unless he's hung from a tree and, you know, something along that line. And the president, they quickly expelled the two leaders of this chant, and now they're trying to do damage control by this young man, Levi Pettit, and his peers running around and grabbing a hold of as many black leadership as they can get their hands on to try and wash themselves clean. And one of these who orchestrated this was Anastasia Pittman, who's a state senator in Oklahoma, as well as an alumnus of Oklahoma University, who was one of those who was reached out to. Now, I heard this woman on a radio program on my Sirius XM radio, and what she said to one of the hosts was that the reason why they came in holding this young man's hands was that he was scared of the community and how black people would do to him. So I'm scratching my head and I'm saying to myself, he was scared that black people were going to do something to him. When the heck has black people ever went into a white community and did anything to them because of some racist chant? We only have to look at Emmett Till when they came into Emmett Till's grandfather's house, kicked in the door, snatched the boy out of his bed and took him away and lynched him. Black people don't go looking for white people to go and do things. That's why we've been continuously abused. They come into our area, do whatever they want. So for her to sit up there and say the reason they came holding this boy's hand was because he was scared, it was a whole bunch of malarkey. I want to say something else, but this is a family radio program. I'm not going to get like that. You know, it was a bunch of nonsense. And then for her to say that, you know, that he didn't know what he was talking about because he was not aware of lynching. Now I'm saying again, you, Treece, this is Dallas, Texas. How the hell did Texas become a part of this republic? Then they had to lynch and separate themselves from Santa Ana in order to become up here. Has she listened and has she read the history of East Texas, Longview, for instance? You have all of these places where black people were ethnically cleansed in the 1990s, the red summer of 1990, where all across Texas, east and west Texas, where black people were lynched and they were ran out of town. Well, how do you think so many people from Texas end up in California? It's because their grandparents had to run for their lives and leave everything behind to run into Texas. So when she is saying that he does not understand about lynching and he didn't know what he was doing, this is the same nonsense of this black misleadership class that Glenn Ford likes to term it, that we have been elevating as of late, who like to make excuses and say that these people need education, they need to learn what it is about lynching. If you're going to tell me you're a white boy of a very prestigious family that lives in Highland Park, Texas, Dallas, Texas, I said before, the school that he went to, it costs over $40,000 a year in tuition. This is a high school now that he was paying $40,000 a year in tuition. And you're going to make excuses and say that he didn't know what lynching is?
And you so let me ask you.
Texas native?
So what should, in your view, what should the leadership have done in this situation?
My thing was this, you know, and then, of course, the last excuse she made was all about voting. You know, they got to throw the voting part in, like, we don't take part in voting.
We know the bring the source to the polls. That's the final appeal for everything. But
exactly.
what should she have done? If she were an inspiring leader, what should she have done in that scenario?
What she should have done is tell this young man that, you know what, no, we are not going to provide you backdrop or cover for this. If you are genuinely sorry for what you did, you need to go out here and you need to go do it on your own. You're not going to have black people standing behind you to provide you moral support and holding your hands and saying as if though we're going to let it all wash and come saying, oh, these children make mistakes. We need to allow them to make mistakes. This is not the type of mistake that we need to let somebody get a pass on. This is not a mistake, Utree. This is a deliberate act. A mistake is if you go out here and you accidentally hit somebody's mailbox because you're texting on your phone. That is an accident or a mistake. This is something that you learned and you got on a bus and you got into it and you were saying, because this is not the first time he has done it on a bus.
Okay, but I'm saying, I'm looking now, you're criticizing the leadership. Let's hear from you what the proper way would have been. What would have been the more efficient and the more useful way for her to have used her leadership here?
Her leadership should have been to say if he wants to show that he's really contrite and penitent about what he has done, go into the black community and work quietly within the community to show that you really mean change, not that you're trying to use me because you want to get back into the university or you want to get back into your membership of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter, because this is the ultimate goal is what they're trying to do. It's like he wants to get back into those two organizations. But he's going
right,
to
and this is why I think you're slightly missing the mark here a little bit. I'm surprised at you, Sarah, because the work that he needs to do isn't in the black community.
In his own community.
No, that's exactly the point. That's where he needs to go to work.
But what I was going to say, if he wants to show that, he can work in the black community, but he needs to go back in his own community and tell them the same expensive school that he came from, he needs to go up there and he needs to do a class and says, hey, look, I learned this mess from being here in school with my family, my association, and I have done it, and this is something that we're going to need to stop because we know the history here of Texas. Texas came into being because we committed genocide on the indigenous inhabitants here within this state, as well as we stole it from the state of the Republic of Mexico. This is the history of Texas.
I get it. I understand what your point is, but here is where inspired leadership should reject this and say the problem is you not only harmed the black community more than anything, you absolutely verified the pervasive attitudes within your own community. Your job.
Mm-hmm.
is to now go back to your community and start the work. This is, you know, even in journalism, I used to say this all the time. We have a lot of folks who get a lot of attention because they do black stories. They go to far-flung corners of the world and they report on, you know, the black and brown and Asian people who are suffering, and they write books and they come back. And then
yeah.
they become authorities on these things. And I said, well, wait a minute. I'm not impressed by that. I want to know, how often have you gone to your own community and exposed the seamy underside of racism in your own community? Now, that is impressive to me.
I've been doing this work all the time in my own community. Everybody knows who knows me. I have been lambasting useless black leadership for more than 40 years. That's the work that I need to do in my own community. But we see no such, very little such work, even by journalists. They don't go into the white communities where they come from and confront their own communities on their racism. I remember going to the funeral of a supposedly very liberal person, the father of a very liberal person. And we get there. Some of us, we all went in together to pay our respects. And we're the only black people in the place. And, this was supposed to be an extremely liberal family. And the person we went in to pay respects to was a colleague of ours. Well known, mm-hmm. big time. But mm-hmm. absolutely living in an all-Jewish community with restrictive covenants, have no problem with all of that. But this is what it is I'm talking about. They don't do the work in their communities.
And they're not going to do the work you treat, because they know that if this is, like I keep telling people, this is not about ignorance, that white people who practice racism, white supremacy, is not about ignorance, because you cannot run a system and claim ignorance that you don't know what's doing. You know, you intentionally know what it is that you're doing, but you are playing this avoidance game. And you're very good with words that you use in order to deflect and hide what you're doing, because this system can only function as a result of you practicing deceit and cunning. And that's how it is done. And a lot of black people, we become complicit, because we provide cover by making excuses, because what that state senator was doing, as well as the head of the NAACP, the national chapter, Cornell Brooks, as well as the president for the Oklahoma chapter came on and what they were saying, it made me very nauseated. I was ready to have a nosebleed listening to this.
We don't need you having nosebleeds out there. You know, look, we are clear about what it is. It is what it is. And what needs to happen, again, the community needs to call up the senator to listen. You were less than inspiring in the way you responded here. And also to the young man, the job that he has to do is to work in his own community. You go to your own community and confront it and say, what I was involved in is the outgrowth of what you taught me. And, that's what needs to be. But thanks so much for your call today.
Quickly, you treat someone to say this. Lastly, what makes this even so offensive to making sure that it's not genuine, she said one of the other boys who was on the bus with this other Levi Pettit, he's all lawyered up, and he's about to get litigious because he hired the attorney that represented Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing, and he's threatened to sue the school to get himself reinstated into the school. So you see where this is going. These people are not sorry. They're not sorry. They're only sorry they got exposed, that this stuff was put out here for the whole world to see it.
Yes, it is a shame. But again, the point is there's a two-part effort here. The leadership that did this, of course, you find this all the time. Remember Bill Clinton? They couldn't wait to get down to Washington to expunge him of his peccadilloes. But here you have the same kind of thing. You could always count on people. There will be somebody who just doesn't get it, and they're willing to be used in some of the most embarrassing ways to compromise the integrity of the whole community, and saying, well, we are generous people and we are understanding. Come on. It's a very simplistic way of operating. But the major point here is that where they miss the mark all the time is to be used in a manner of saying, well, we absolve you of blame, rather than say, now your job, don't come to us. Your job is to fix your community that raised you this way. That's your job, to undo that. you go ahead and you have our blessing to go back to your community and begin to unravel all of this nasty stuff that you're now carrying. You've been infected, and you need to go and work on that infection. Thanks, sir, for your call today. 888-874-4888. We haven't heard from Keith Cook, so we probably would hear from him next week. Still holding out hope that at some point during the program they would be able to break away, but understand that they are right now as we speak in a face-off with the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections over the severely deteriorated health of Mumia Abu-Jamal. 888-874-4888. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Eutrice.
Thank you.
Yes, I was calling in reference to a
and
while
who's
back.
Who's calling you, today? Tell me
it's
who's calling.
Gamba.
Oh, great. Gamba?
Yes, Gamba, yes.
And from,
uh-huh.
and from where?
Originally from Trinidad.
That makes you a perfect person. But where are you now?
I'm sorry, say again?
Where are you calling from now?
The D.C. area.
Okay, from D.C. Great. Gamba, thank you for joining us today. And welcome as a first-time caller. This is really, really wonderful.
Thank you. And I have a bone to pick with you. It's about reflection and utilizing words of our past orators at times to just put forth our understanding of or our consciousness of what's happening in the world. So that said, I already picked my bone at you.
But you didn't say what it was. I didn't understand
it. You were adamant that, you know, you didn't want to hear what, say, Marcus Garvey said, or what Dr. Ben may have said, or what Malcolm X said back in those times, and people often come up and recite those verses that they had used to express their thoughts. And I'm saying, well, Eutrice, I think you're wrong in that if 20 years from now I remember what Eutrice said on one of her shows, and I would like to utilize this now to express my thought to others, then it's only a viable way for me, or a viable option for me to now express my thoughts and say, well, Eutrice uttered these words, and I'd like to say this so you get a better understanding of what I'm trying to say to you. Get my point?
Okay, well, let me respond to that. What I meant, and what I was hoping that, I had communicated, was that it is not enough. I'm not impressed by people who quote people to me. I'm not impressed by that. Mm-hmm. Because I know that a lot of people just do that for effect. I'm impressed more by whether and to what degree you implement the words that of instruction to you. To just stand up there and, you know, Marcus Garvey said this and the, you know, Malcolm X said that. That's great. Wonderful. Now, could you tell me, in as much as, you know, you're quoting all this at me to make me understand that you are culturally evolved, I get that point. Great. You know, got it. But I'm more impressed with your practical application of the instruction that they left. That is impressive to me. So that's really what I had said it for, that it is not enough to be running around quoting people, you know, like now that they are safely dead and everybody becomes a hero when they're dead. Mm-hmm. Because when these folks were fighting, battling in the interests of their people, the supporters were hard to find. But now that they're safely dead, so everybody loves Malcolm X.
Yeah.
Everybody loves Marcus Garvey.
Yeah.
Even Dr.
Yeah.
Ben. Everybody loves Dr. Ben. Dr. Ben was taking on the academic world, blistering wars going on.
Yeah.
Where were his cohorts? Where were the people who now talk about how wonderful he is? Yeah, this is what I mean.
Yeah.
Don't quote me, Malcolm, and don't quote me, Garvey. Quote me where you have been able to apply, or where you literally take their instruction and have applied it in your practical day-to-day life. That's what I meant.
I can attest to what I did in the past. I lived in the Detroit area, and I worked with a major airline out there. And we had aircraft that came and sat for the night. So at one point in time, I met with some brothers at the Urban League, and they had come to Cobo Hall with some young men and women, children, I should say, from their schools there in Pontiac, Michigan. And what I did was I took it upon myself to ask my supervisors and management to bring the kids on board, bring them up to the aircraft, show them through, and let them have a feel and understanding of what aircraft, the aviation industry may present to them as an option for making a living. And that's how I see it, as you were saying, you know. I quote Malcolm and I quote Marcus, and but I also apply that we as people in the African world trying to get from behind this deficit of cultural values that we have, we must have many different skills and apply it day to day. So that's where I see myself. You know, if I could teach somebody how to rebuild an engine, I do that.
Then you're all right with me.
Yeah. My other point, and let me try to make it quick, is the influence or how the police force creates narratives and also influence thought and action. A story of talking about Arima in Trinidad. A friend of mine left his house. He would often come back up on vacation to the States. And there was this individual who was a pest in the neighborhood, and he roamed or marauded through the neighborhood, harassing the people and the elderly people in the neighborhood, stealing their stuff, breaking into their house, and so on. And the police knew about him. He was an addict as well. So in Trinidad, as you know, they don't have support systems in which they could really counter some of these delinquencies. Anyway, so. My friend had some dogs in the yard, and he saw the guy, and he says, "Hey, I see you back here again. I'm going to get you." And the guy flipped him off, and they got into words. He let the dogs go. The dogs were vicious dogs. They got the man. Needless to say, they bit him up. The man died. The police created a narrative whereby, okay, the man was in the yard, right? Yeah. All right, that's it. That's it. I think I'm a bit I'm not explaining this fully, because at the end of the day was that this man died because of the dogs, and this other man was not convicted or even charged with anything because it was an out for them. As I reflect on Ferguson and Staten Island with the incidents of black men, the police could create the narratives, and so be it, you know.
So
I don't know if the story I really expressed it clearly for you to understand, but they're the front
right,
line.
I get where you're going. You're saying that, in effect, that it should have caused a more humanitarian response, and it should have caused at least an investigation. I mean, it's not enough simply to say, well, the man was in your yard, meaning he got what he deserved because he was trespassing. And, of course, with the history that he had of being a nuisance and, you know, breaking in or whatever it was that caused him to be an objectionable presence in the neighborhood. But at the same time, what you're pointing out is, does that mean he had no rights at all?
And, you know, does that mean that there was no reason to respond to him on a humanitarian basis and within the context of the law? Should the man have these kinds of dogs that would typically attack a person to the point of death? I mean, I understand what you're saying. So the narrative was that the police, in that sense, had decided to function as the judge and jury, and they made a decision based on the man who was killed being not worthy of, you know, not worthy of the same rights as any other citizen by virtue of his past. They made a judgment.
Yeah.
I get that. Thank you.
Could I just influence those of us who listen about the book A Century of War by F. William Engdahl? I think I heard you mention that before, haven't you? Or it may have been Gary Null.
It may be Gary. Yes. I don't remember mentioning it.
Yes, yes.
But thank you so much for your call and welcome. Really, I'm so delighted that you could join us today.
I thank you for accepting my call.
Thank you. Ciao. We have time for at least one more. There we go. 888-874-4888. You're on the air on Lead Stories. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, this is David D. calling from Brooklyn.
Hello, David. How are you?
Getting along well. What I called today to talk about was what they call education, which I really think is not education, but is training. Because education, to me, includes empowering people who are being educated. And what I wanted to talk about was analysis of what's going on in the quote-unquote education area, and also what I'm trying to do to correct it and what I have done. And that is important because I feel that the oligarchy that runs the U.S. is trying to reverse all the social and economic infrastructure that is in place. And so I want to talk about what they're doing in education. The last couple of days, the governor has gotten a deal where he's turning teachers into temp workers, reducing their tenure, doing all kinds of things to attack teachers, and this is very important. Now, in the area of what I call schooling, there is an attack at all levels, primary level, secondary, and tertiary levels of schooling. And they're trying to put in neoliberal changes. In other words, on the college level, most of the professors teaching are now adjuncts rather than tenured track people. So that's part of the attack on the college level. Students are forced to take these massive loans, and I feel that education, true education, should be a human right, and that is another thing they're doing. In many areas, these are private-profit schools and colleges that they're getting together, able to exist on government grants and loans. They tend to sign up many marginal students who cannot pay for these massive loans. On the secondary and primary levels, they have a frontal assault against teachers who are, what they say, are in bad schools. They don't carefully design what they mean by bad schools. Teachers are, for example, told they're not as good as teachers in other countries. Student test scores compared to students in other countries, while ignoring or not having any knowledge of the situation in those other countries. And the main thing that's never mentioned or hardly ever mentioned is the economic and social factors that affect children who are enrolled in schools. Anywhere you go, rich children who don't have those burdens, those social and economic burdens as poor children, tend to do better in school. But they never talk about that. They only talk about blaming the teacher for being a bad teacher and ignoring all the other factors that affect how well a child does in school.
So, David, could you tell us, you've given us a kind of groundwork here. What have you done? You said you were going to tell us what you're doing.
Yes, well, I spent many years as a teacher, and I was in a special area, the area of aviation technology. And many of the children that I trained are now pilots all over the world. As a matter of fact, I'm writing a memoir right now. It's nearly finished, about the success of many of my young people who came from poor families, many of them from Trinidad, incidentally, and the success they've had. So I've made, I believe, an impact, and my book will be out sometime later on this year. What I'm saying is it's not a question of just pointing out what's wrong, but I've done something about it, and I'm very happy about that. The other thing I want to talk about is we live in a society, according to New York Times, I think it was last year, I read an article where in the juvenile prison system in New York, they spend over $200,000 per child on incarcerating some child. They spend huge amounts of money in adult prisons also, not as much, but they do practically nothing supporting the families that these children come from and putting it into the regular schooling to improve the conditions of the children who are in school. I mean, I was very sickened to see that the people here in New York want to hire 1,000 more police people, which is ridiculous. I can imagine what you could do with all that money that you give these police people supporting children in school, especially at the lower levels, and families in terms of employment, economic things, and handling all the situations that children are faced with, social conditions, bad housing or no housing, homelessness, health problems, attendance problems, all the factors that affect children could be helped by that. And if that was supported, and then you wouldn't have to spend over $200,000 to lock a child up, or maybe $60,000, $70,000 a year to put a person in prison. So
you've given us a great deal to think about here, David. And
yes.
I couldn't agree with you more. Education happens to be an area that I'm particularly interested in, and you're touching on quite a bit here that should have occurred to leaders, political leaders, decision makers by now. But of course, we know you use the word oligarchy, and that's exactly what is running the system right now. The governor is basically I mean, he's a champion of charter schools, as you know. He even stood on the rostrum of the charter school movement, preaching the advantages of charter schools. So, I mean, we'll be doing a lot about this in the coming weeks. But thank you so much for your call today, and welcome to Lead Stories, and for your thoughts, and for your contribution.
Yes, and I'm going to give you an advanced copy of the book.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. Very profound thoughts from Joel, Sarah, Gamba, and David. Thank you so much for making this program very, very useful and a community of interest. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And you may want to reach me. I always enjoy hearing from you on leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As we close the program today, this is the week that many celebrate Passover and Easter. To those of you who do, have a great one and the best wishes. And we will see each other, hopefully on Monday. We'll be talking some more. And thank you so much. Tell at least 10 people you know that this is the program that you listen to every day and the station that you turn to every day for information that really does matter. And until then, understand from me, it's a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.